Hello and welcome to The Wire, your independent national coverage of a current affairs right across Australia on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Mimini Shakur coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. And today on the show...
We have recognised that that has influenced people's attitude towards other winter preparedness vaccines, which is very unfortunate.
Experts urging action as Australia's worst flu season hits record cases as vaccination rates drop.
It's impossible. Even though they just don't like it, it's killing tourism because they're taking every power point out of even malls just to stop that maybe happening.
Homelessness in Gold Coast is more complex as some refuse shelter. And later today...
It's a day to feel proud of your identity. Doesn't matter which part of Africa you come from. A day of connection.
This Saturday, Australia will celebrate its largest African cultural festival in Sydney. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Australia is facing its worst flu season on record, with over 410,000 confirmed cases in 2025 alone. Despite the surge, flu vaccination rates have dropped, especially among young children and older adults. I spoke with RACGP Victorian Chair Anita Munoz, who is calling for urgent action, including wider access to needle-free vaccines, to help turn the tide before next year.
Look, I think that there's myriad reasons for that, and one of the causes undoubtedly is that people became quite vaccine fatigued over the pandemic. And while a lot of that was directed at the COVID vaccine itself, we have recognised that that has influenced people's attitude towards other winter preparedness vaccines, which is very unfortunate. I think we also have people not aware or not appreciating that influenza remains a really important and can be a deadly disease. And so an underappreciation of the risk may make people feel that the vaccine is not relevant for them, whereas we actually know that influenza can strike really anyone. And myths like the fact that you haven't had influenza recently somehow protecting you from influenza in the future continues to be present in the thinking of some people. We also know that there's been a significant drop-off in vaccination rates in some populations, including children under five and in people aged 65 and over. And that's particularly worrying because they are priority populations, because influenza tends to be much more severe for those people.
How often would you recommend to take, I guess, the flu vaccine?
Yearly. Yeah. So we do know that it's a virus that's very capable of changing season to season. And so it is a condition we need to be updating our immunity every year. So I certainly would encourage people to be doing that yearly. Even if you're not in a population that we're particularly worried about things like hospital admission and death, it still is a terribly miserable illness to have, even if you are in good health, and it stops people going to school and going to work, and it can mean weeks and months of recovery afterwards. So I think, like all infectious diseases that we have vaccines for, prevention is better than cure.
And how can needle-free vaccines like the nasal spray help improve vaccination rates, especially in kids who are often vulnerable?
I think that it's a really important development, and I think that being able to say to a child who's hesitant or needle phobic that there is an option to have a needle-free flu vaccine is an incredibly important breakthrough. We know that there are states around Australia that have decided to adopt this, and I continue to remain concerned that in Australia, which is such a modern and first world country, that we could have an inequitable healthcare system whereby a child in one state can have access to certain public health measures and not access them in another. So I think this is a really excellent case in point about the need for harmonisation between our health systems so that all Australian children have a fair access to what's a really important development in in vaccination and public health.
Well, the winter season's ending and we're moving into summer. Would you recommend someone who didn't take the vaccine this winter to take it in preparation for summer?
So the behaviour of the flu this year has defied the traditional patterns of transmission that we've seen in previous years. So I certainly think we are seeing people continue to get influenza, even though we're now in October, I do think if you are a priority population, the answer would be a resounding yes, because those people are still doing very poorly when they get the infection. And I also think that anyone who gets on a plane or travels or goes into environments where there are lots of people in enclosed spaces, that's exactly the kind of environment you're going to contract influenza in. So I think for such a simple intervention, if it saves you from getting influenza or potentially ending up in hospital, then I'd encourage people to do so.
That was RACGP Victorian Chair Anita Minogue speaking to The Wire. Homelessness has been an ongoing issue on the Gold Coast, but could it be that some of our rough sleepers are turning down opportunities to find shelter? It seems to be the view of the Queenslander Housing Minister, Sam O'Connor. However, the situation is more complex than just finding shelter. The Wire's contributor from The Source News, Josh Gorman, reports.
How could you cope living on the streets not knowing where you could sleep? Homelessness has been rising in media coverage, but many don't understand how difficult it is to find shelter and safety. This rise in homelessness has brought to light the increasing amount of people living rough who have decided to set up tent cities and parks to create community and safety for each other. Michael has experienced homelessness on the Gold Coast for almost 20 years, and the tents that were good for community and shelter have been forcibly removed by the Gold Coast City Council.
What's happened is that the council now is exposed to this task. It's these badges and uniforms with unit standard point badges. I'm about to make my own little syndicate for unit standard point today. And they've come in and taken our stuff. Long story short, I kept going and I said, I don't know where to go. It's illegal to go anywhere. So I can't leave this park because I need you to tell me where to go. If it's legal, I'm not moving.
When speaking to Michael, it was clear that the conditions on the streets weren't the best, but he valued the friendships and community he had.
Friendships and fellowships everywhere.
Yeah.
You get choices on what you want to do for the day. We're lucky enough to be on the Gold Coast, so there's tourism, so you can always talk to new people. It's good. It's good to have support and when you're going through trouble.
But on the other hand, building owners and council had made things harder by taking away access to things such as PowerPoints.
It's impossible. People, they just don't like it. It's killing tourism because they're taking every PowerPoint out of Riva Malls just to stop that maybe happening.
Queensland Minister for Housing Sam O'Connor says emergency accommodation and services are offered regularly and a good portion of rough sleepers do accept this help.
There's a whole range of complexities that people experiencing homelessness have, but there is help available and we would want more than what we're getting to engage. We get about a 50% success rate, but we'll be out there and we'll keep doing it because it's our role and we want to make sure that the people who will engage are able to have those pathways into longer-term tenancies.
Mr. O'Connor says, although homelessness is a complex issue, the public informing services is essential for them to offer better support.
We need to get that through to us so that we can action that and we can get our outreach teams out there. We've got specialist homelessness services as well that we fund to do the out-of-hours outreach. They do a fantastic job and they act on the information that we're provided and we need to have that information coming in. It's really valuable and we appreciate it whenever people reach out and let us know what's happening.
He does, however, reiterate that the Gold Coast City Council is in charge of these parks.
We need to know that people are in these areas. We have a homelessness hotline that we run 24 hours a day. You can let the council know as well, because if they're in one of these parks, then that is ultimately council's land and it's a responsibility of theirs to take the action that they feel is right.
Although Mr. O'Connor says there's work being done to address the issue of rough sleeping, Shadow Housing Minister Megan Scanlon disagrees. Ms. Scanlon thinks changes to legislation has made it harder for people to receive support.
I think a number of the changes the Queensland government have brought in have made it more difficult for people to get access to sort of hotel, motel, emergency crisis accommodation. Different people call it something different, but basically it was a dedicated fund that used to exist that was available for specialist homeless services to offer people who were sleeping rough emergency accommodation for however long they needed it was the previous government's policy.
Ms. Scanlon also highlights changes to eligibility have cut people out like Michael from receiving support.
Unfortunately, the new government has come in and made a whole range of changes that just cut a number of people out, basically. So that one of the changes was saying that people have to be on the social housing register. Now, there can be a range of reasons why someone might not be on the register. And to be honest, that register, the eligibility criteria, hasn't been updated in nearly 20 years. When I was the minister, we committed to reviewing that because it should be lifted, I think, in line with, you know, today's modern income standards. Even though they might be in their tent tonight, they might not then be eligible for emergency housing either.
Another major issue with the changes to the new laws is the addition of citizenship requirements, which I mentioned to Ms. Scanlon when I told her about Michael's story.
That's another change they've made to the immediate housing response guidelines, that you have to be a citizen. And if you're not a citizen, obviously you're not eligible in most cases for social housing either. So there would be multiple grounds that person would be knocked out from getting emergency accommodation. There are a lot of Kiwis living on the Gold Coast in particular who do access some services, but this, you know, some of these, as I said, changes have made it really difficult for people to get basic shelter.
It's clear that homelessness is an extremely complex issue, but with more support, we can make a difference.
The Source News, Josh Gorman with the report. You're listening to The Wire, your independent national coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Amina Shaku from Melbourne. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on ACCC 102.1 FM. And to our friends in Noosa on Noosa FM 101.3. And to the other side of the country, to Radio Goolari in Broome, Western Australia. The community radio sector lost one of its highest rated programs earlier this year after giving voice to regional and remote towns across the Murray-Darling Basin. Water Watch was a weekly program broadcast out of 2DRY FM in Broken Hill and across the network, covering everything water in the years following a number of significant fish kills near Menindee. After 3 years, 100 programs, and a Walkley Award nomination, the program stopped production in July. Noah Sacombe spoke with Megan Williams, one of the former hosts of Water Watch, to reflect on the impact of the program.
Being based out of Broken Hill and doing a show on water, what was that like covering this topic from a place like that?
Water is a very large topic. The way it's understood is different depending where you are. So in Broken Hill, they're not on the river there. It's about 100 kilometres from the Darling Barker, which did supply Broken Hill with its water for a very long time. But in about 2018, they built a pipeline up from the Murray River at Wentworth and disconnected the Broken Hill town water supply from the Darling River. They're very much at the end of that northern basin system, and you see the impacts of a degrading river system from the bottom up. And so they've been on the front line of degradation across the Murray-Darling Basin, at least in the north, for a very long time. And so people there are very passionate and engaged on those issues.
What are your reflections on the way that the different state and state governments manage water between each other? What is that actually like?
Chaos, in a single word. So we took the approach that water policy is actually really quite inaccessible to the average people. It's very complex, it's very convoluted, and in many ways it's designed to be so. It's very simple that water is life for people out on the rivers. And so Water Watch was really about trying to make that complex policy accessible to the average person by telling the stories of the people that lived on the river. In terms of the intergovernmental politics, there's four states in the Murray-Darling Basin plus the ACT. It's overseen by the federal government as well through the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. So they meet quarterly or three times a year through MINCO, the Ministerial Council for the Murray-Darling Basin. That's the water ministers of all states and territories and the federal government to lay out a whole host of different policies and plans. There's water sharing plans that the states manage in terms of allocating the water, and they work into water resource plans that work into policy. The jurisdiction is federal and state, and then within those states as well, you have different political interests that want to see different things out of those policies. So it's a complex beast, and there's a lot of interests that change widely.
I particularly want to get your perspective on the Water Minister of New South Wales. I don't even know if she's still in that position.
Rose Jackson, yes.
Yeah. She still
Water, I believe,
Minister?
So. Minister for Water, Minister for Housing, Minister for Homelessness, Minister for Mental Health, Minister for Youth.
So obviously speaking with someone in that role who is directly responsible for water for really quite a large chunk of the two rivers, is there anything that kind of shocks you about the way that politics works around this?
Well, I feel like in politics you should always expect the unexpected. After the election, she was one of the ministers that came out within a couple of days of the election when was the mass fish kill in 2023. I mean, in terms of how politics works out there, the thing that is interesting and surprising is that Menindi and the Darling River Action Group and the community out there is incredibly vocal and very much on the front line of the degradation of the river system. But they do have this incredible lobbying capacity as a town that's smaller than probably most city primary schools. So what is interesting out there is the access to politicians in some ways, because it is such a focal point. I used to say that if you sit in the Maidens Hotel in Menindi for long enough, you will meet everyone who is anyone on water, because in the few years that I was out there, a lot of politicians from all sides of politics and wannabes would blow in at some point. And there's only, you know, the limited number of meeting places. And yeah, if you sit in that pub long enough, you will meet everyone. So I guess that's kind of one of the really interesting takeaways, the power that the community does have. You could argue that given the state of affairs, the power that they have maybe is not that great, but their voice is very strong and it has been ignored for a really long time, but they've also been able to make their case for a very long time.
That sense of community and, I guess, giving a voice. Looking at what Water Watch was for the community, what do you think is the significance of having a space to go into this, but also to offer a platform for people that otherwise don't?
We had a lot of in-depth conversation with a lot of different people on the rivers. A small community radio program, listening to you and getting your story out there can mean a lot to people. In some instances, it made a big difference, you know, that the Wulkanya Weir story that we covered, which was when we had the minister on the program, she apologised to the community about the way that it had been handled. Now, 18 months on from that, and she's in the news saying that they're looking for the federal government to front up the rest of the money, you know, and at the time when we were talking back then, it wasn't about money. So they are real world impacts of getting people's stories out there and getting them heard.
You can watch the full interview in the latest edition of From Pillar to Post on Community Radio Plus app. AfroCultures is Australia's largest African cultural festival, held at Cathy Freeman Park in Sydney. It's a vibrant celebration of African music, dance, food, fashion and community. I spoke with Fatima Muhammad, festival director, about how the event brings people together to honour the rich African traditions.
Well, AfroCultures is a really fun, exciting annual one-day event held in Sydney at Cathy Freeman's Park at the Sydney Olympic Park. The festival celebrates African cultures through food, music, art, fashion, traditional, and anything African, really. Be our 17th year. It is the largest African arts and cultural festival in Australia. And the main aim is just to bridge that cultural gap, increase awareness of the African communities that are in Australia. And also, I think more importantly now, with so many Africans in Australia, it provides a space for the artists, the business, and a lot of cultural expressions in Sydney. The festival is on, obviously, this Saturday, 25th October. We start 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. at Sydney Olympic Park. So I'd encourage everybody to come down.
What are some of the events you'll have at the Cathy Freeman Park in Sydney?
On Saturday, so the festival's organically grown through communities. So come there on Saturday, you'll find the Food Nile Court, which offers just African cuisine from across the continent, really. We try to balance so that you have food from the East, the West, the North, and Southern Africa. So for a lot of people, especially in Sydney where we live, there's nowhere to go to have African food. So this is the day you can experience real African food. We've got two stages, Kilimanjaro and the Serengeti stage. So that has live music and performance, dance, drumming, and you find both traditional and contemporary acts there. We've got 70 stalls. They're selling everything African, you know, arts, fashion, accessories, homeware, handmade goods. So anything African for the day, you'll get there. The fashion parade is normally, stops everybody. It showcases, you know, design, just the vibrant African colors. So people are asked to dress up for the day and take part in the fashion show. And there's always prizes for the best dressed male, female, children, community. But that's very exciting, and everybody gets engaged with that. Yeah. We've got the workshops, which is drumming, and the Ethiopian coffee ceremony normally is a favorite with the crowds. Watoto Corner, which is the children's corner, a lot of activities, painting, African face painting, which is people are surprised. They go, you do dots like the people in Australia. And it's the dots, mask making, African games. So the festival in itself is very inclusive, not just for African people, designated for everybody to engage, children, families, and just enjoy the vibrant cultures. Yeah. And in fact, we tell people it's cheaper than going to Africa. This way you can experience the diversity in the African continent. Last year we had over 43 different countries present. You know, they didn't necessarily have a stall, but through the survey picked up 43 countries present, and we had over 40,000 people attend the day. So it's a really fun day.
Yeah, sounds like a busy itinerary. A lot happening on Saturday.
Well packed day.
I know you mentioned that AfriCultures is the largest African festival in Australia. Do you get people coming over from other states across Australia?
Definitely. We had people's stalls coming from as far as Perth. This year they haven't made it across Perth, but Melbourne, we've got lots of whether they're jewelry, African fashion, Adelaide, Brisbane, and across the state here in New South Wales. So yeah, they do come across from everywhere now.
AfriCultures is a celebration of African cultures here in Australia. What does an event like this mean for African communities, especially, you know, in terms of identity and representation?
I think a lot of them feel a sense of belonging on the day, and the surveys, there's been an impact survey that was done through AfriCultures, and what comes strongly is it's a day to feel proud of your identity. Doesn't matter which part of Africa you come from, a day of connection, a day of being safe, and also a day of cultural exchange. So people feel like that day gives them the opportunity to exchange their cultures, make friends through culture. So it's very important for the African communities as a day to show off themselves, in other words, come and, you know, show all their colors.
That was Festival Director Fatima Mohammed speaking to The Wire. You can catch African Cultures this Saturday, 25th of October, at Cathy Freeman Park in Sydney. And unfortunately, that is the end of today's show. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SEI in Sydney, Radio Adelaide for Triple Z and Radio 4EB in Brisbane. With the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, X, Instagram and LinkedIn. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, where the program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. I'm Amina Shakur, coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.